because he thought it was, quote, easy, which allowed him to spend as much time as he wanted working on his startup while taking computer science and engineering classes on the side, though he ultimately dropped out of Stanford during his senior year. He boasted to anyone who would listen that he had a $500 million idea. In another era, investors would have steered clear of a college dropout making such an outrageous claim. But in the 1990s, this sort of over-the-top bravado was exactly what people expected from young tech geniuses. When Steve Jobs used his charisma to overcome or hide inconvenient facts, people called it his reality distortion field. As Lamont demonstrated, Jobs was far from the only entrepreneur adept at distorting reality. Lamont himself admitted to the Stanford Daily newspaper that the initial product, quote, sucked. But once they finally got it to work, Trilogy sold a major software deal to Hewlett-Packard. Silicon Graphics, a large technology firm that had pulled out of a deal with Trilogy, came back to the table, asking to renegotiate. Lamont responded, "We will, but the price has tripled." Silicon Graphics gave in and was followed by major clients such as IBM, Alcatel, and Boeing. Thanks to Trilogy, businesses could create giant custom catalogs. Imagine all the options that might come with a plane, for example, that salespeople could use to drive deals. Trilogy was off on one of the greatest runs for a software company in tech history. With Trilogy still in startup mode and Microsoft ratcheting up the competition for talent, Lamont made a decision about hiring that might have been the single biggest bet of his entire career. He wagered that talented, overachieving students with zero real-world experience, that is, people like him, would be the key to Trilogy's success. As a result of this decision, the vast majority of Trilogy's hires were new graduates, and more experienced adults became a rare breed. Jocelyn Goldfein says the ethos of the company was, "We're elite talent, it's potential and talent, not experience, that has merit." With Lamont's believing passionately that success could only flow from a meritocratic hiring process, quote, "only the best," became the shorthand with which Trilogians described themselves and the candidates they were looking for. If this philosophy now sounds familiar, that's because Lamont's bet would affect the recruiting process for tech companies for decades to come. Trilogy turned college recruiting into an art form, writes one Austin reporter. The company targeted top schools such as Princeton and Stanford, plying students with gifts ranging from CDs of Austin bands to computers and even cars. One female recruiter, a non-techie who was one of Trilogy's top recruiters, passed out laptops to students at Berkeley and hosted lavish dinners at top restaurants in San Francisco and Palo Alto. "You name it, there was no limit in terms of where we'd take people," she says. "There was no accountability or structure. It was just, here's a credit card, go figure it out and find some engineers." The Trilogians of the future were made to feel more special than they'd ever felt in their lives. Former Trilogy director John Lilly, who went on to run the Mozilla browser and become a venture capitalist at Greylock Partners, one of the industry's top firms, recalls a red convertible Mustang waiting for him at the airport. Most important, the recruiters were mainly women who were, quote, "all 22 and hot," as one former employee put it. Trilogians had fun speculating about which recruiters were former strippers. There's no evidence that any of them were, and which might be hooking up with the boss. "Joe was a total bro," one former Trilogian told me. "The bro thing started way earlier than people think." His idea, quite clearly, was to hire good-looking women who, in other circumstances, might never give an engineer the time of day. Of course, the unstated premise of this hiring practice is that the target candidates, the students who'd be flattered and excited at the attentions of these sexy recruiters, would be men, not women. The Culture Fit Challenge. One of the assessment measures Trilogy helped pioneer, which became widely used in the industry, was to have candidates demonstrate how well they could think on their feet by conducting a quick succession of brain teasers. Gary Cho, who was taking postgraduate computer science classes at Princeton before being hired by Trilogy as a product manager in 1998, likened the interview process to an American Idol competition. "You would go through round after round of brain teasers on campus," Cho recalls. "These tests included questions like, how much would you charge to wash all the windows in San Francisco? And how many piano tuners are there in the world?" What did these brain teasers actually test for? There's little to suggest that they had anything to do with being a good coder or engineer. More likely, they helped Trilogy hire people who were a cultural fit. The company was looking for people with extreme confidence, those who would happily riff on a problem about which they had no actual expertise. On its face, an offer from Trilogy was the opportunity of a lifetime. Kids right out of college were trained as quickly as possible and given the chance to run major parts of the business immediately so they could have instant effect. At the same time, early Trilogy executives compared building the company to building a cult. "The first thing you have to do in a cult is isolate," Trilogy's former vice president, John Price, remembered 2 decades later. To achieve that, Lamont had moved the company from Palo Alto to Austin, Texas in 1992, which at that time wasn't the tech hotspot it is today. "The reason Joe put it in Austin was so you didn't have anything else to do," says John Lilly. "If we're in Silicon Valley, we'll go out and screw around. But in Austin, there's nothing else to do except go out and drink." The company was oriented towards drinking and working very hard. Everything was very intense. Hired at age 24, Lilly would have been just another cog in the wheel at a big tech firm, but his first job as a Trilogian was as a director on Lamont's staff. New hires immediately spent 12 weeks bonding and training at a company boot camp called Trilogy University. The idea was to push new recruits to their limits with an unrelenting series of technical and emotional challenges while simultaneously indoctrinating them with Trilogy's core vision and values. Price said they wanted to create cohesion and bonding at the level military guys have in a foxhole when they have bullets flying overhead. Then added, "If you ever study cults, this is how they do it." Recruits, encouraged to display their youthful bravado, emerged with extreme confidence and a near patriotic devotion to Trilogy. After graduating from TU, new hires plunged into the company culture of hard work and hard play. "I worked nonstop," says Christy Jones, Trilogy's sole female co-founder. "I didn't go on vacation. We called holidays competitive advantage days because no one else was working. It was a chance to get ahead. I would drive home at 11:30 at night." By the end of the work week, everyone was ready to let loose. Aside from only the best, another Trilogy motto was "money, recruiters, beer, repeat," according to early employees. "Friday at 5 p.m., party on the patio," says John Lilly. At 9 p.m., the team might grab dinner at a Mexican restaurant, then spontaneously hop on a plane to Vegas, often led by Lamont himself. Inevitably, they'd stay up all night, crashing in suites at the MGM Grand through the weekend. Lamont was notorious at the tables and in strip clubs, becoming known as $100 Joe. He would expect his team members to bet all or nothing at the tables, not just hundreds, but thousands, and sometimes even tens of thousands, of dollars at a time. This sort of boorish behavior was talked up as a part of the Trilogy ethos, important because it cultivated people's willingness to play for the highest stakes and taught lessons about risk and reward. The Trilogians would catch a flight back to Austin on Sunday, hydrate, and go to work on Monday, even more devoted to $100 Joe. Challenging male behavior has been in companies forever. This was one of the first tech companies that really spiked it, Lilly told me. They did hire some excellent women, but also did a lot of things that were problematic for women. Insane work hours, drinking, gambling, Vegas, strip clubs, throw in the prizing of youthful brilliance over experience, and this was the company culture that new and prospective employees knew they needed to fit. When you have a culture that is so male-dominated, where drinking is a huge part of the culture, where you're talking about doing deals in the millions of dollars, every aspect of that is going to kind of reek of a certain mentality, says Gary Cho. It's completely hostile for women. Trilogy was among the first in a long line of tech startups that required assimilating into a culture of masculine arrogance that many people, women especially, might not want to sign up for. Not every man is happy and productive in a bro culture, but women, as a group, are especially unlikely to feel comfortable. Much peer-reviewed social science suggests that men, whether due to nature or nurture, are more given to the particular type of grandiose self-assessment displayed by the many tech wunderkinder, dating all the way back to Jobs himself. In a paper that consolidated 31 years of research on narcissism and involved nearly 500,000 participants, Emily Grijalva of SUNY at Buffalo found that men consistently score higher than women when it comes to narcissistic traits, such as exhibitionism, feelings of entitlement, and the willingness to employ unethical or exploitative behavior to get ahead. Trilogy kicked off an era in which lofty self-confidence seemed to be a critical qualification for both tech entrepreneurs and the engineers they hired. Recall those brain teasers that Trilogy and other major tech companies used throughout the 1990s and into the next two decades? There has never been any evidence that they were useful in measuring who would be a good programmer. Yet it took until 2013 for Google to finally stop using them. Brain teasers are a complete waste of time, Google's longtime former head of HR, Laszlo Bock, admitted to the New York Times in 2013. They don't predict anything. Well, maybe not anything useful, but they may have been good predictors of the sort of hyper-self-confidence men are more prone to. When an employer asks something like, how many golf balls can fit into a double-decker bus, he or she was basically saying this to prospective candidates. We're going to ask you a question that has no relation to your job and one you've had no training in how to answer. Do you have the chutzpah to pretend that you can? Men are far likelier than women to take risks like these and to feel comfortable doing so. Jeff Trickey, managing director of Psychological Consultancy Limited, a group of business psychologists, studied risk-taking behavior in over 7,500 people and found that risk-takers, who are both impulsive and fearless, were twice as likely to be men as women. On the flip side, female risk-takers were roughly twice as likely to be more wary and judicious than men. Additional compelling research suggests that high-achieving women suffer from imposter syndrome, a term coined in 1978 by two psychologists, Pauline Rose Clance and Suzanne Immes, to summarize how women feel undeserving of their success. Despite their concrete achievements, these researchers said, women often believe they are not that smart and will eventually be exposed as frauds. Other researchers have found that women won't apply for jobs unless they meet 100% of the qualifications, while men will apply as long as they have 60% of the boxes checked. Imposter syndrome has been found in all kinds of industries, as well as in professions such as law and medicine, where the metrics for success and achievement are widely understood and agreed upon. How well, then, could women be expected to fare, on average, in the dot-com world of the 1990s, when success almost required a willingness to be an imposter? Companies were worth what investors believed they were worth, and investors based their assessments on the founders' claims, often wild and fanciful, and their aplomb. Lamont's recipe for success turned out to be a recipe for disaster. Though investors clamored to buy shares in a Trilogy IPO, Lamont kept Trilogy private, allowing the company and employees to experiment with new businesses. PCOrder.com, which involved preloading entire computer systems with Trilogy software and selling them over the internet, became Trilogy's first spinoff. In 1999, at the height of the dot-com bubble, PCOrder.com went public, raising $46.2 million, big bucks back then, on its first day of trading. Trilogy chased the hype, building multiple other online businesses, selling everything from cars and appliances to insurance online, powered by the company's original sales software. As the dot-com boom hit fever pitch, Trilogy and its subsidiaries commanded stratospheric valuations, but had little to show for it. None of them were very good, Lilly says of the various businesses. He ultimately left Trilogy after 16 months for a job at Apple, because he didn't share Lamont's values. Even the company's core product was mediocre. The ugly truth was that the sales configurator was a piece of crap software, a former employee told me. It was super complicated, hard to use, and required tons of professional services fees. The model was hype up crappy software to sell expensive consulting hours. On top of this, some of the new businesses started to overlap, and Trilogy began competing with itself. PC Order's stock plunged, but not before early Trilogians made bank. Jocelyn Goldfein, who worked at PC Order, says everyone got rich off a company that was basically nothing. Trilogy was full of hubris, the hubris of the era, except theirs predated the era. The company was the early 1990s model for a type of bluster and risk-taking that would come to characterize Silicon Valley over the next decade. For Trilogy's 10th anniversary in 1999, Lamont flew hundreds of employees to the Bahamas, where they stayed at the Atlantis Resort, and gifted employees crystal vases from Tiffany and bottles of Dom Perignon. When the first tech bubble burst, Lamont's net worth plummeted, and in 2001, hundreds of Trilogy employees were laid off. Today, Lamont is quietly running a downsized Trilogy and keeping a low profile in Austin. He did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Could women have prevented the dot-com bust? Lamont's bro style, his volatile mixture of entitlement, hubris, and risk-taking, came to be shared by many founders and CEOs in the 1990s, and investors applauded. If you weren't promising to create a billion-dollar company, the VCs didn't take you seriously. Given that entitlement, hubris, and risk-taking are the very personality traits that show significant gender differences, it's little surprise that so many of the founders selected for investment were men. There is plenty of blame to go around for the dot-com crash. With everyone in the system making so much money, few were brave enough to call bullshit. In 1996, the Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan famously warned of irrational exuberance among investors, so many of whom threw money at companies with outrageous price-to-earnings ratios. It took four more years for investors to understand his message, and when they did, it was a financial catastrophe. Starting in the spring of 2000, $5 trillion in market value was lost in less than 2 years. When the bloodbath stopped, fully half of those promising dot-com companies no longer existed. Until the crash, there was little incentive to stop the game, including among the business press, which did as much cheerleading as investigating. But if investors' love affair with bro style helped fuel the boom, and it did, it's fair to ask, if more tech leaders of the 1990s had been women, could they have helped avoid the bust? Or mitigated it? While no control group exists for history, the question is worth considering. For example, researchers like Jeff Trickey have speculated that the financial crash of 2008 might have been significantly different had women played a more prominent role in high finance. Risk-taking is desirable and required in the workplace, but we need a balance to avoid it spiraling out of control, Trickey wrote. If you're not recruiting people of all risk types, you're missing out on a fundamental self-controlling mechanism. It's a bloody good formula for survival. Of course, individual men and women may not conform to the conclusions of Trickey's research, but his findings do suggest that the simplest way to create a balance between risk-taking and caution in a business is to make sure you have a gender-balanced workplace, and other research bears that out. An extensive study by the Peterson Institute for International Economics, a nonprofit that studies international economic policy, analyzed nearly 22,000 publicly traded companies across various industries in 91 countries. The study found that companies whose leadership was at least 30% female were 6% more profitable. There's no reason to believe that tech, specifically, would be any different. Had more women participated in the first dot-com boom, we might have had fewer make-it-or-break-it unicorns, and instead had a healthier herd of bust-resistant workhorse companies. After the crash. The loss of $5 trillion certainly changed the tech industry. Investors became more cautious about out-of-whack price-to-earnings ratios and business plans sketched on the back of cocktail napkins. But while many mid-level employees were hurt when the bubble popped, some founders walked away with millions. Many became the venture capitalists whom we will meet in the next chapter. And because they had emerged from the economic rubble as winners, their idea of who should be running tech companies, young men, did not change. As VCs, their influence in the industry only grew stronger, while women's position languished. According to data compiled by the National Center for Education Statistics, in the years after the bust, 2000 to 2008, the percentage of women earning computer science degrees plummeted another 10%, holding steady at around 18% until 2011. That's a far cry from the near 40% peak, remember, in 1984. Once again, women had lost ground, and dramatically so, compared with men. Why did the bursting of the bubble hurt women more than men? Perhaps women were discouraged by the tough competition as thousands of newly unemployed computer programmers flooded the post-crash job market. They might also have been responding to a then widespread fear that once lucrative tech jobs would disappear or move offshore, making it chancier to pursue a career in Silicon Valley. To women, the tech economy might have looked like a tightrope they didn't need to walk. By 2004, the year Google went public and Facebook was founded, the industry had recovered, and there were plenty of jobs to go around. Silicon Valley was resurrected as the dream destination where entrepreneurs, who fit a certain stereotype, could become millionaires overnight, and lower-level employees could get rich simply by picking the right company to join. Tales of enormous fortunes spread, igniting yet another California gold rush. In 2010, the movie The Social Network further glamorized startup life and established Mark Zuckerberg as the exemplum of what a successful founder looked like. And the men flocking to the epicenter of technology continued to vastly outnumber women. Today, it's estimated there are more than 500,000 unfilled tech jobs, a number that's expected to balloon to 1 million by 2020. The industry is facing a labor crisis much bigger than that of the 1960s when Cannon and Perry canonized nerds as the ideal hires. Talent is in super short supply now, and yet the stereotype of what makes a good engineer continues to exclude half the population. Silicon Valley recruiters say it's a pipeline problem, meaning that there aren't enough women graduating from college with the necessary technical skills. If they had more qualified women to choose from, hiring managers will tell you, they would hire more of them. And many of them mean it. Missing from this explanation is that the tech industry itself created the pipeline, which is very narrow and built on fanciful assumptions about what it takes to participate. Also missing is any acknowledgement that from its earliest days, the industry has self-selected for men. First, antisocial nerds. Then, decades later, self-confident and risk-taking bros. That these assumptions have greatly harmed women is obvious, but I would also argue, for reasons discussed in this chapter, that they have also harmed the individual tech businesses, the industry as a whole, and our ever more tech-focused culture. How different our world might be had the designers of those early screening tests not decided that people who don't like people made for the best programmers. What if women had been encouraged to join the tech industry rather than having been ostracized by it? What if Telly Whitney and tens of thousands of women like her had spent their working lives in a welcoming atmosphere instead of an isolating, hostile one? How would our economy and culture be different now if the leaders of the 1990s internet and personal computer revolution hadn't been so remarkably full of themselves and comfortable risking trillions of investor dollars? But instead of this alternate universe, we have seen the rise of the nerd bro dream and the codification of an ultimate boys club. Chapter 2. The PayPal Mafia and the Myth of the Meritocracy. The last time I interviewed Peter Thiel, we were on stage at the LendIt conference in the spring of 2016. Thiel, a co-founder of PayPal, was perhaps at his high point of cultural influence. His book, Zero to One, which posited a new way to think about innovation and build successful companies, had a long run on the New York Times bestseller list and was a huge hit in China and other foreign markets. The presidential election was only 7 months away, but during our interview, Thiel claimed he would have nothing to do with it. Just weeks later, he declared his support for Donald Trump, a move that would cost him considerable social capital among the Silicon Valley elite. The day I spoke with him, however, Thiel was still seen by many as the philosopher king of Silicon Valley, partly because of his founding role in PayPal, which sold to eBay in 2002 for $1.5 billion, and his wide-ranging investments from Facebook and Tesla to bioengineering and nuclear energy, but most recently because of his influential book. Hailed by The Atlantic as a lucid and profound articulation of capitalism and success in the 21st century economy, it had become required reading among tech entrepreneurs and other heavy hitters. On the LendIt stage, Thiel wore the standard VC uniform, well-worn jeans, black belt, and an immaculately pressed open-collar white shirt. He was sweating. Not, I think, because of my penetrating questions, but because he's just naturally uncomfortable in front of audiences and under stage lights. Though not a particularly polished speaker, he stammers and repeats himself, he appears to think through each of his answers in the moment, instead of relying on prepared talking points. Over the first two-thirds of the interview, he made interesting and insightful points on issues such as the evolution of the Chinese economy, the state of American politics, and the future of technology. Then I asked him about the lack of diversity among the Silicon Valley elite. 2 weeks earlier, Thiel's 11-year-old venture capital firm, Founders Fund, had made headlines for hiring its first woman partner, Cyan Bannister, the wife of Scott Bannister, an early PayPal board member. I asked for Thiel's take on the lack of women in the venture industry as a whole and where the responsibility lay for the disparity. "We all have a responsibility to do more," he began. "The disparities are really big. There's something about tech that matters a lot. There may be a huge disparity in chess players or math professors, but but that doesn't matter quite as much as the only industry that's really working in the U.S. The critical issue, he went on, was the lack of women as founders. By his count, only 2 women were founders among the 150-odd unicorn companies, those worth over $1 billion. Thiel said, what really defines the culture in Silicon Valley is not the executives or the venture capitalists, it's the company founders, and that's probably the place where the disparity is the most extreme. This serviceable answer got little reaction from the crowd. He acknowledged the problem, cited some data to illuminate the situation, and agreed that the issue was important. What was his prescription for changing things? I don't know what to do about that, he admitted. Full stop. Thiel has been an industry leader for 2 decades, yet he took no personal responsibility for tech's gender disparity and apparently had no thoughts about how to fix it. The subtitle of 0 to 1 is Notes on Startups, or How to Build the Future. But when I reread it after the conference, looking to see how he'd addressed this critical issue of women being left out, I found that this huge disparity wasn't even mentioned. In fact, he'd managed to write the entire book without once using the word woman or women. I was left suspecting that this big, important responsibility to do more wasn't in fact much on his mind. Thiel's apparent lack of interest in women's status really matters, because Thiel isn't just influential. He is the undisputed don of a group widely known as the PayPal Mafia, a cadre of men who constitute one of the many reasons Silicon Valley became so dominated by white men of a certain age and educational background. To understand just how deeply the beliefs, decisions, and actions of this group have affected the industry, we have to go back to the mid-1990s and meet them, when they were a band of brainy misfits at Stanford University. Contrarians by nature. Keith Raboy, a PayPal alumnus who is now a leading venture capitalist, clearly remembers the first time he met Thiel. It was Raboy's first day as a Stanford freshman, and Thiel, a junior, was walking through the dorms handing out copies of the Stanford Review, the conservative student paper he had co-founded. Thiel normally slipped the newspaper under closed dorm room doors, but Raboy's door was open, and the pair got to chatting. Raboy, a conservative himself, was immediately intrigued by both Thiel and the firebrand paper he was editing. Not long after, Raboy told me, he became part of the group of unruly college students, none of them computer science majors, who had banded together to share their right-wing ideas with the rest of the generally left-leaning Stanford population. We knew nothing about tech and talked mostly about politics, he says. In fact, they were studying law, philosophy, and government. Raboy remembers feeling as if he and his peers at the Stanford Review were, quote, outcasts in a liberal school. Thiel himself told me he, too, often felt like an outsider growing up. An immigrant with his family from Germany, he attended 7 different elementary schools as a child, was raised evangelical Christian, and found himself questioning beliefs as widely accepted as Darwin's theory of evolution. At Stanford, refusing to conform to the prevailing views of the other students became a point of pride. We all started most questions with an anti-conventional wisdom bias. It almost didn't matter what the topic was, Raboy tells me. They were contrarians by nature. No one should be forever judged by the certainties they had when they were undergraduates. Nevertheless, the ideas expressed by Thiel's group at Stanford are worth re-examining, because the ideas they formed in the 1990s inform the worldview they hold today. And given the PayPal Mafia's outsized influence in Silicon Valley, this group of men's worldview has affected our culture and changed a lot of lives. In the early 1990s, many universities were working to create a more multicultural curriculum. And Stanford began by instituting a new program called Cultures, Ideas, and Values. It required students to read a more diverse set of authors, including more women and minorities, rather than just canonical works such as Plato, Shakespeare, and the Bible. There was also a push to create more diversity among students and faculty. Thiel and his colleagues at the Stanford Review saw these efforts as deeply misguided, writing that this was an attempt by professors to impose their personal anti-Western and anti-patriarchal beliefs on the student body. Universities should be blind to gender and race, they argued. Whites and Asians shouldn't lose academic posts to candidates from more underrepresented groups. Only measurable achievement and academic merit should matter. They also questioned the value of diversity and the idea that universities, companies, and governments function better when a broad range of people participate. We were pretty critical of affirmative action. We forecast how it was going to play out, saying it's going to really, really penalize Asians. And that's exactly what happened, Raboy told me, referencing a recent lawsuit against Harvard University that alleges Asian Americans are discriminated against in the admissions process. The Stanford Review also targeted feminism. David Sachs, a Stanford Review columnist who would become the early COO at PayPal while Thiel was CEO, authored several pieces in a 12-page issue devoted entirely to criticizing the new awareness about date rape and sexual assault. The word rape in bold letters takes up half the front page, and the issue includes a piece on how to avoid sexual assault charges, complete with ways to thwart the, quote, feminazis, punctuated by a modified swastika. In one editorial, Sachs wrote, if you're male and heterosexual at Stanford, you have sex, and then you get screwed. One Stanford friend who disagreed with Thiel about diversity is former PayPal executive vice president Reid Hoffman, who says his relationship with Thiel was forged on their willingness to debate opposing points of view. Thiel had heard there was this pink Okami, and I had heard there was this right-wing Attila the Hun, Hoffman told me of their first meeting. On politics, I don't think there's anything we agree on. When their debates turned to diversity, Hoffman says he told Thiel, look, I don't disagree with you, there is a certain amount of political correctness on the left, but the issue of diversity is real. But Hoffman was the exception. Most of Thiel's group, though prescient about the overcompensation that could potentially be caused by college's political correctness, were libertarian firebrands who promoted their views like a brigade of militant free speech avengers. If one of their purposes was to rile the mostly liberal student body, they succeeded. To prove just how committed he was to the First Amendment, Raboy once yelled, faggot, hope you die of AIDS, outside the home of a Stanford administrator who had reportedly kicked a student out of university housing after months of anti-gay harassment, including using the word faggot behind closed doors. Raboy took responsibility for the remarks at the time, writing, the intention was for the speech to be outrageous enough to provoke a thought of, wow, if he can say that, I guess I can say a little more than I thought. Maha Ibrahim, who also went on to become a venture capitalist, was majoring in economics at Stanford during this period and recalls the pronouncements of the Stanford Review with a shudder. It was just bad. I felt it was just this isolated voice that was so extreme that it was horrible and incredibly unfortunate, she told me. The liberal backlash was so great that Raboy, who by this time had graduated and gone on to the university's law school, left Stanford and finished his JD at Harvard. As for Thiel, after graduation, he went on to earn a law degree at Stanford, then clerked for a U.S. Circuit Court judge, worked as a securities lawyer, and wrote speeches for the former Secretary of Education, William Bennett. In 1995, Thiel and Sachs took the ideas they had developed at the Review and expanded them into a book, The Diversity Myth, Multiculturalism and the Politics of Intolerance at Stanford. Multiculturalism, they wrote, caused Stanford to resemble less a great university than a third-world country, with corrupt ideologues and unhappy underlings. Revisiting their critique of feminism and calls for gender diversity, they wrote, the passionate hatred of men, the utopian demands for an elimination of all gender differences, the totally inconsistent demands for a uniquely female perspective, and the belief in widespread gender discrimination are the core of the new gender studies curriculum. They even defended Raboy's faggot remark, likening the campus backlash to the Salem witch trials. Both Thiel and Raboy came out as gay years later, and in 2011, Thiel told The New Yorker he wishes he'd never written about the Raboy incident. Raboy told me, it was a stupid thing to say, but I'm not the only person who did something stupid in college. Thiel and Sachs have also publicly walked back some of the book's other arguments, such as their assertion that date rapes were often no more than seductions that are later regretted. Thiel commented on that for the first time when his donation to Donald Trump's presidential campaign, just a week after that Access Hollywood tape revealed Trump boasting about kissing and grabbing women without permission, called attention to the views Thiel had earlier espoused. More than two decades ago, I co-wrote a book with several insensitive, crudely argued statements, he told Forbes in 2016. I wish I'd never written those things. I'm sorry for it. Rape in all forms is a crime. In late 2017, however, Stanford Politics, another student publication, published a lengthy article in which undergraduate staff members of the Stanford Review said that Thiel still meets with them on a regular basis and hosted an after-party at his home to commemorate the Stanford Review's 30th anniversary. There, one former Stanford Review editor said Thiel claimed he apologized only to appease the media, saying, "Sometimes you have to tell them what they want to hear." A spokesperson told me that Thiel stands by his original statement to Forbes. Sachs, for his part, told Recode's Kara Swisher of the diversity myth, "This is college journalism written over 20 years ago. It does not represent who I am or what I believe today." When I asked Sachs about the book myself in 2016, he pointed to the women on the executive teams at the companies he's run to prove how much he cares about their advancement. "I do believe in diversity, and I've always sought to create the best teams possible," he told me. But 20 years ago, when the diversity myth first came out, Thiel and Sachs had little need to defend or denounce the book because no one took much notice of it. At the time, Thiel was just another conservative up-and-comer, a minor player in the traditional power structures of politics in Washington and finance in New York. That was about to change. PayPal, when meritocracy means people like us. One day in 1998, Thiel was guest lecturing about currency trading at Stanford when a young Ukrainian engineer named Max Levchin sneaked in to, as he told me, sleep and get some air conditioning. Instead, he wound up listening. At the end of class, Levchin introduced himself to Thiel and mentioned that he wanted to start a company. He had already started four that had failed, but he wasn't about to give up. The next day, the two men had breakfast and hatched the idea for PayPal over a Hobie's red, white, and blue smoothie. Suddenly, a former securities lawyer with no technical background was the unlikely co-founder of what would become a billion-dollar startup, and the group that would become the PayPal Mafia began to form. Sachs became PayPal COO in 1999. In early 2000, PayPal, then called Confinity, merged with a competing payments company called X.com, run by a then-obscure entrepreneur named Elon Musk. Raboy became Thiel's right-hand man. PayPal's founders, investors, and early employees went on to become a tight-knit and very wealthy group. To this day, Raboy believes PayPal is a, quote, "perfect validation of merit," and of Silicon Valley as a meritocracy. "None of us had any connection to anyone important in Silicon Valley," he told me. "We went from complete misfits to the establishment in 5 years. We were literally nobodies. People wouldn't talk to us. Everybody thought we were weird. One tech publication ran a story called Earth to PayPal. Everybody thought we were insane." The early PayPal team would go on to found some of the biggest companies in Silicon Valley, including Tesla, SpaceX, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Yelp. Thiel funded and joined the board of Facebook. Establishment achieved. Hiring only people like us. So who were these nobodies without industry connections, and whom and how did they hire? While Raboy believes they were devoted to the idea of merit, of hiring only the best, that is simply not what happened. Thiel and Levchin, in fact, have been remarkably upfront about whom they wanted to employ, people who were a lot like them. Years later, in 0 to 1, Thiel would explain their reasoning. "Because startups have limited resources," he wrote, "they must work quickly and efficiently in order to survive, and that's easier to do when everyone shares an understanding of the world. The early PayPal team worked well together because we were all the same kind of nerd." Except for the office manager, who was female, those first employees were all men and all of a similar age and educational background. Thiel admits in the book that when starting PayPal, he didn't sort through resumes looking for the most talented people. Mostly, he just brought in the buddies he'd worked with at the Stanford Review. Levchin, for his part, hired friends and old associates from his time in the computer science department of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. In fact, Levchin tells me PayPal's first 15 engineers were basically lifted straight from a computer graphics group he ran on campus. "There was never any time wasted on how do you do this sort of thing. We had exactly the same approaches to everything," Levchin says. He points out that these engineers came from a range of ethnic backgrounds, but allows that none of them were women, quote, "because we didn't know any." The idea that these men just happened to be personally connected to the most talented people available is simply ridiculous. Even Raboy acknowledges that it was almost impossible to get a job at PayPal without a connection to the company. "We were very network-driven in hiring, and they were weird networks." The members of the PayPal Mafia explicitly believed, and some still do, that hiring an ideologically diverse group of people early would slow the company down, when all they wanted to do was move faster. I don't think you can have first principles debates in a startup in the beginning, Raboy told me. In the beginning, it's better to have people who are more similar ideologically than different. Once you have alignment, then I think you can have a wide swath of people, views, and perspectives. Amy Clement was one of the earliest women at PayPal, not because Thiel or the others hired her, but because she was working at Elon Musk's X.com when it merged with PayPal in 2000. Clement told me, PayPal was a high-intensity driving culture, full of impassioned debate. Socializing took the form of chess tournaments rather than fratty parties. Employees worked 18-hour days, 7 days a week, as they worked to build a secure online payment system that could rival the global banking industry. There were tense discussions, at times anger and slamming doors, Clement said. But despite their own admission that they were hiring from people they knew personally, Clement confirms that Thiel and other executives often talk about how PayPal was a meritocracy. We used the word meritocracy a lot, and I do feel like we were very conscious of who was really performing, she said. Clement, one of the few women at the company, became a product manager reporting to David Sachs. David had a strong point of view on what the product should look like, but I also feel like I would share my points of view and we would work through things. As the early PayPal staff rose to prominence, Thiel, in particular, became famous for his strong views. I think there is this way in which human beings can act in sheep-like, lemming-like, herd-like ways, Thiel once told me in a Bloomberg television interview. And I think that's a disturbing truth about human nature that we should try to resist as much as we can. I think there's probably something about the general homogenization of our society where people are brought up in increasingly similar ways that probably does limit the amount of creativity one can have. Obviously, Thiel didn't consider himself one of those doomed lemmings. But how does one find other non-lemmings? Just look for unusual behavior. In his book, Thiel notes with pride that of the six people who started PayPal, four had built bombs in high school. In our interview, he told me, there's something that's always quite extreme about the personalities that go into starting a company. Having some extreme personalities, I think, is a somewhat good thing. The beliefs of the PayPal founders that individual merit is the most valuable metric of human potential and that creativity is deadened by groupthink have deeply influenced the post-crash tech industry and are consistent with the ideas promoted by Thiel's cohort at Stanford. There are many counterarguments to this thinking, but I'll focus on one of its glaring flaws. Peter Thiel, who champions unbridled individuality, is in fact describing a groupthink of his own. From his Stanford days onward, Thiel has largely surrounded himself with Ivy League anti-establishment contrarians whose opinions are similar to his own. The review editors might not have been the most popular group at Stanford, but they were a group nonetheless. They took their particular brand of groupthink to PayPal and their subsequent companies, propagating it through Silicon Valley, with consequences far beyond the PayPal walls. That's why, when Thiel and his cadre advise companies to focus on individual merit in their hiring, we need to look very closely at how they define the term. What are the metrics they use for determining people's merit? And why does this particular type of meritocracy seem to reward jobs and stock options only to a razor-thin demographic? Thiel expresses no regret about the narrow criteria he used in staffing PayPal. I ended up recruiting a lot of people I'd become friends with at Stanford, he told me. Levchin did the same, hiring from his own alma mater. The co-founder's example was then repeated, Thiel says, by those hiring at the lower levels. Let's get people like us became ingrained as company culture. It was always, you know, is this somebody that we'd want to work with and could become friends with over a long time, Thiel said. That was a question we always had in the background. Levchin, however, admitted to me that his early approach was flawed, recalling a specific moment where I consciously realized, wait, we are doing something wrong. One day, his girlfriend, who later became his wife, told him, if you don't hire a woman now, you'll never hire a woman. I would look around the office and say, I'm not going to be the first woman here. By then, hiring had slowed because Levchin was running out of University of Illinois recruits to vacuum up, and he was perplexed about what to do. We don't know anyone else. We've already hired everyone who looks like us in our little social circle. We realized there was a plateau moment where we had to fix that problem, Levchin recounts. That's when PayPal started to cast a wider net and hired a female head of engineering, Jane Manning. Manning had all the necessary technical skills, but more important, she enjoyed ping pong. I was completely smitten with her, Levchin says. She came into the interview and said, let's play ping pong, and I said, hey, that's awesome. She's instantly fitting in. But just a few weeks later, Manning left for a job at Google. Reflecting on her time at PayPal, Manning told me, the problem was a cultural one, not necessarily a lack of women, but if there were more women, the culture might have been better. There was a certain overconfidence among the engineers. I wanted a little more process that could have protected us from mistakes, something that I think women can be more sympathetic to. I do think there can be a sort of macho all-male environment of we don't make mistakes. For example, Manning had to fight to get the team to use a bug tracking system, and one engineer programmed it to play the hamster dance song whenever it loaded. The team, conversely, felt they could keep track of whatever they needed to in their heads. On top of this, Manning never quite hit it off with Thiel. I was uncomfortable with Thiel's political views, Manning told me. I remember learning that he had met a lot of other early PayPal employees at the Stanford Review, and really had a moment of feeling that these were not my people. PayPal did manage to hire more women as the company scaled, and acquired women like Amy Clement in the merger with X.com. But the team at the top, the one that would go down in history, was all male. As they cashed out of PayPal and dispersed to start new companies and join or create venture funds, they would wield extreme power and influence in Silicon Valley. Many of the companies they went on to found or be associated with became the most successful and highly valued companies of the decade. Anyone who had boarded the PayPal rocket ship early seemed to have a ticket to unprecedented opportunities and automatic success. Every one of them became very rich. Not one of them was a woman. A photograph of the PayPal Mafia on the cover of Fortune magazine in 2007 pictures the men posing as gamblers with cigars, drinks, and a deck of cards. It just makes me cringe that there's not one female in that photo, says Amy Clement. It drives me crazy because there were some really successful women at PayPal. While they might not have been founders, these women, she says, were written out of history. Did the mythical status the PayPal Mafia acquired perpetuate the idea that successful startups were founded by groups of male friends? Was PayPal somehow responsible for this notion that women couldn't, or just didn't, found companies? They absolutely created a template, because having watched what the PayPal Mafia did and how incredibly successful they were, why wouldn't you imitate them? Roger McNamee, co-founder of the tech private equity firms Silver Lake and Elevation Partners, told me. When it comes to the idea of hiring your friends or people like us, McNamee adds, they didn't just perpetuate it, they turned it into a fine art. They legitimized it. These guys were born into the right part of the gene pool. They wind up at the right company at the right moment in time. They all leave together and go on to work together. I give them full credit for it, but calling it a meritocracy is laughable. The PayPal Octopus. The ultimate reach of the men in that Fortune cover photo is astonishing. After the sale to eBay, the PayPal Mafia unfurled like an octopus and deployed its tentacles all over Silicon Valley. Members were forever bonded by what they'd shared. As Thiel told me in our interview, there's something about the set of us, the set of my friends from PayPal, where this was just an intense experience. And I think that those bonds can probably never quite be matched in their intensity. And as those men dispersed, their relationships became the currency in which they traded. They joined one another's companies, funded one another's ventures, defended one another's controversial public statements, and more. For Founders Fund, Thiel partnered with two less prominent PayPal co-founders, Ken Howery and Luke Nosek. The partners at Founders Fund invested in their old PayPal buddy, Elon Musk's space venture, SpaceX. Musk also co-founded Tesla. Founders Fund, along with Max Levchin and Keith Raboy, invested in the workplace chat company Yammer, which was founded by former PayPaler David Sachs. Yammer was ultimately sold to Microsoft for $1.2 billion. The list of begats goes on. Sachs went on to become COO of the fast-growing HR software startup Zenefits. When the co-founder of Zenefits, Parker Conrad, was kicked out amid accusations of cheating state compliance regulations and creating a bro-y culture that led to sex in the stairwells, according to an internal memo, Sachs was promoted to CEO. Sachs promptly brought in Peter Thiel as a board member. Even though the valuation of Zenefits was slashed amid the cheating scandal, it still reached $2 billion. Sachs has since left Zenefits. And this is just a partial list. The PayPal Mafia became so dominant that in 2017, Adam Pizzoni, an entrepreneur who never worked at PayPal but was recruited by Sachs to be his Yammer co-founder, cited what he called the mafia's, quote, dynastic privilege as one of the major contributors to the lack of diversity in Silicon Valley. I am a product of the PayPal mafia dynasty, Pizzoni wrote in a Medium post. I co-founded Yammer with one of the original PayPal mafia members. Yammer had an easier time raising capital because of our PayPal connection. Yammer, like PayPal, had an all-white, all-male founding team, which hired mostly white men from their networks early, who all in turn benefited greatly from Sachs's mafia ties. Pizzoni continues that it was then easier to raise funds for his next startup because of his Yammer connection, thus perpetuating the dominance of a selection of white men. Or, as Roger McNamee sums it up, show me something the PayPal mafia isn't involved in. Reid Hoffman acknowledges how much he benefited simply by knowing Thiel. Because Peter and I were classmates, that ended up being a huge inflection point in my career, Hoffman says. Having co-founded the professional social networking site LinkedIn, which was funded by the prominent venture capitalist Michael Moritz, who had originally been on PayPal's board, Hoffman has spent a lot of time thinking about how networks can impact diversity outcomes, for better and for worse. When you're hiring the first 20 people on the team, you don't go, who's the most different from the other 19 people that we have? That's not useful, Hoffman explains. Should it be all white men of a similar socioeconomic class? Well, no, that's more likely to run you off a cliff. The most important thing, Hoffman believes, is that all team members, whoever they are and wherever they come from, cohere quickly on the company mission. Hoffman eventually sold LinkedIn to Microsoft for $26.2 billion. When I ask him if networking is part of Silicon Valley's gender problem, he says if he could do it all over again, he would go back to his college days at Stanford and network even more, not less, and especially with women, because he's seen the incredible benefit of a single friendship. Clement agrees that dynastic privilege in tech is a problem. I think it's gotten worse, where people are hiring from their networks and their friends, she says. The money flows easily around the PayPal mafia, and hiring flows easily around that group. But I think that's how labor markets work. The elite are connected with the elite. It's very logical. You're going to invest in people you know and trust more than you're going to invest in people you don't know. We should enable ways to break through and enable others to get in. Unfortunately, networks like the one created at PayPal are hard to get into once they are established. You have to be one of the gang, a known quantity, much like the real mafia. The power that these groups wield and the business momentum they create are hard to overstate. Jeremy Stoppelman and Russell Simmons, both in the Fortune photo, started Yelp, which went public with a $1.43 billion market cap. Max Levchin funded Yelp and later joined as chairman. Chad Hurley, Steve Chen, and Jawed Karim came up with YouTube, which sold to Google for $1.65 billion just a year after its founding. In this particular so-called meritocracy, whom you know is critical. Michael Moritz of Sequoia, who funded LinkedIn and PayPal, also recruited PayPal CFO Roelof Botha to join Sequoia as a partner after PayPal was sold. One of Botha's first investments was YouTube. Because he had just returned from his honeymoon with several digital videos and no way to share them, he was primed to see great potential in YouTube's fledgling site. Luckily, the founders were three of his old PayPal friends. Botha also funded Xoom, the international payment company started by early PayPal investor Kevin Hartz. Xoom sold to, wait for it, PayPal for $890 million in 2015. Meanwhile, University Ventures, now Y Ventures, a fund started by Hartz along with Keith Raboy and Jawed Karim, made an early investment in Palantir, another company co-founded by Peter Thiel. Raboy also worked for Hoffman at LinkedIn and became COO of Square, funded by Sequoia's Botha. He left Square in the midst of sexual harassment allegations involving a male employee, which he denied, and became a general partner at Kosla Ventures. Between his stints at LinkedIn and Square, Raboy also became executive vice president of the social app company Slide, started by Max Levchin and backed by Thiel's Founders Fund. It was at Slide that Levchin learned the hard way that having a male-dominated team like PayPal's wasn't always a recipe for success. Max Levchin's Diversity Awakening. Trace, a Mexican bar and restaurant, is located on Townsend Street in San Francisco's tech-heavy SoMa district, and the staff of Slide assembled there regularly for happy hour. There was definitely plenty of alcohol, Levchin admits. If the boys want to go out and do happy hour, who am I to tell them they can't blow off steam? The introverted Levchin is not one to pound beers at a bar, but many of his employees more than picked up the slack. Jason Rubenstein joined Slide as a software engineer in 2008, a point when the company was going gangbusters because of the popularity of its social apps and games on Facebook. Employees were pulling long hours, each day trying to beat the numbers they had posted the day before. Every team had a mini refrigerator stocked with beer, Rubenstein remembers. But the occasional beer often turned into groups of people starting to drink at 3 p.m., and many of them were drinking to get drunk. According to Rubenstein, one night an engineer got drunk, pushed code at 3 a.m., and took down Slide's entire website. The few female engineers started to feel uncomfortable. At some point, the alcohol culture led to grabby hands at parties, that sort of thing, Rubenstein recalls. If someone says no and it keeps happening, that's a problem. A woman who worked at the company told me that Slide felt like a frat house with an undercurrent of sexism and rumored hookups. Given that many Silicon Valley startups are founded and staffed by young men straight out of college, drinking at the office is common. There's beer on tap at most big tech companies, including Google, Facebook, and Twitter. And you'll often find beer in the refrigerator at small startups to juice those late nights of coding with your buddies. Rubenstein calls Slide's alcohol problem and ambient sexism symptoms of a culture of immature individuals. In these kinds of environments, Rubenstein says, there are all sorts of comments like, gee, that's gay, or gee, do you have a vagina? Which I've heard far too many times to count. Looking back, Levchin wouldn't exactly characterize Slide's culture as brotopia. I think Slide originally had what I call the occasional moral vacuum culture, he told me. Different people chose very different interpretations of what was appropriate or even barely acceptable. His mistake, he admits, was not investing enough time and effort in guiding the culture from the beginning. That error manifested itself in occasional clashes, he said, and led to some plain inappropriate behavior, as well as destructive office politics, including backstabbing and a general lack of candor. When he realized his company was destroying itself from within, he took aggressive action. He removed or pushed out the bros on staff. There were definitely a few, he admits. He apologized to individuals who got caught in the crossfires, gave some "we're all in this together" speeches to the team, and attempted to reset the culture to get Slide on the right track. Despite these efforts, the company itself did not succeed, at least by Silicon Valley's lofty standards. Slide cycled through multiple business models and products until Levchin sold it to Google for $182 million in 2010. After raising $78 million from investors and being valued at $500 million in its final funding round. I could have done so much better. I built a culture that I didn't particularly take pride in being a part of, Levchin told me. He went on to found not only Affirm, but another company called Glow, which helps couples combat infertility. And he banned Happy Hour in hopes of avoiding his past mistakes. Early on, I was very draconian. I said, we will not have happy hour. It's a recipe for bro culture, Levchin says. He has eased up slightly on that edict, but has also established a core set of values, provided unconscious bias training, reached out to female coding groups to recruit more women, and set up beneficial work-family policies. In many ways, I've become much more women and employee-friendly, Levchin says. Max has an inherent sense of fairness. His fairness compass is super strong, says Christina Miller, a lawyer who works at a firm. Equality is very important to him. Miller attests that, at a firm, Levchin has built a much more serious as well as inclusive culture, one that works very hard to empower women. She also says she's never heard Levchin use the word meritocracy, not even once. That's not to say we've never had any HR issues, but most of them haven't revolved around alcohol at all. It's mostly the arrogance of Silicon Valley that's a bigger challenge. By that she means, in an industry that prizes technical talent, some engineers have a tendency to act entitled. To build a healthy culture, Levchin, who's been known to wash his own dishes at a firm, relies on his 2 decades of company-building experience. At PayPal, I would argue all of us were so young and running quickly, Levchin says, while at Slide he made far too many poor cultural choices. With the benefit of hindsight, Affirm is very different, he says. Thiel has made no such mea culpas. Indeed, in 0 to 1, he embraces the term PayPal Mafia, a moniker that is deeply fraught with connotations of misogyny, male dominance, and the brutal exclusion of anyone outside the group. Zero to One has now been read by hundreds of thousands of people worldwide, including many would-be entrepreneurs, all hoping to create their own billionaire mafia. A critique of meritocracy. Believing that they hired on merit from the start, the PayPal mafia has evangelized that Silicon Valley epitomizes meritocracy. If meritocracy exists anywhere on earth, it is in Silicon Valley, David Sachs told the New York Times in 2014. This echoes Raboy's belief that PayPal's hiring practices were a perfect validation.